when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So the positive cash flow was, the aha moment was, even though the cash flow is important, what makes you truly wealthy is this, is what I call a balance sheet build, turning 600 into 1.2, turning 1.2 into 2.2 or whatever the numbers are. And if you're getting starting smaller, it's turning your 10 grand into 20 grand, your 20 grand into 50 grand and getting started.
This is Property Invest Story, where we talk to successful property investors, find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategy. I'm Taran Shum, and in this episode on Property Invest Story, we're speaking to owner of Bradley Property Group, Dave Bradley. We'll follow the property developer through his natural progression from accounting to property investing and development. Hear how he was forced to deleverage during the GFC, and how he turned $640,000 into $1.2 million within 18 months. Also, before we delve into this episode, go over to propertyinveststory.com and subscribe to receive your free property investor case studies, where you'll learn how to generate passive income from your properties. Go there now to sign up for free. So you might be wondering, who's Dave Bradley and what does he do in any given day?
You know, when I sort out my title, when I fly overseas, I still write chartered accountants in the little occupation box that's there. So I'm still a member of the chartered accountants, even though I don't practice it. I stopped doing that about 10 years ago. I guess right now what people would call a full-time property developer. I've got a particular stout with council, so I seem like I fight organisations and I fight bureaucratic processes. It's how it feels like I do it right now. Typically, what I do is I develop properties, and what I say with that is I will take a piece of property, I will try and add value to it by creating more dwellings, and then typically selling off the dwellings. And all going well, that process will create a surplus, which, as you know, is profit, which puts tea on the table for my family and for investors and people that I work with. On a more holistic level, what I do is I run a business and I run money, and I create wealth for myself and my investors, and I do that using property as a vehicle and as a means to doing that. So a lot of the stuff that I do is more using, I try to use my management skills and my business skills rather than my trades and skills, which are not that good.
It's interesting that you say that, because a lot of us say we get on the tools, and when they say get on the tools, it actually just means using their brain.
Thing, or calculate rate per square meter, or selling prices, or GST margins, or whatever. That's the same. My tools are trade as a calculator, which, and I'm lucky that in a sense that being an accountant, I'm pretty good with numbers, and so the calculator in a lot of times is in my brain. So I do have one on my desk just in case of emergency.
Due to his aptitude for trading, he says his property investing skills are terrible.
Said, I reckon I'm a terrible property investor because I don't actually keep anything. I sell everything. I'm a trader, not an investor. So I reckon I'm terrible at that.
Despite not currently holding any investment properties of his own, building a portfolio of developments with Steve McKnight in the past has aided him in his success.
And I think it's probably important to go back as to why that was the case. And so, when Steve and I were getting started, and we were, I'm sure people have heard the story. I'm sure you can tell the story of, we would buy stuff for positive cash flow. And so, go and buy a property, and it would, we'd put down some money, we'd sign for a loan, and it would create a passive income or a positive cash flow result. The problem was, it was really, really boring in a lot of ways. It was really, really, really successful and really, really boring. And so we got to the point, and you went, well, what am I supposed to do now? And so, I think quite rightly, you might say, well, we got to the situation of our positive cash flow was, you know, quite a significant number. But then there's a question of, and then what? And then what do you do? And so, you know, I'll give you rough numbers. If you owned a property that you paid $100,000 for and it's spinning off $1,000 a month, a week, a year, whatever, it doesn't really matter. What do you do when the property's worth $200,000 or $300,000 and you start going, and what I created myself or the knowledge of, I suppose, or the thought process of was, well, why don't I sell that property for $200,000 and I'll invest $200,000 and I'll go and do it again and again and again. And so, I started talking about the velocity of money and, trying to turn a buck into $2 and $2 into $4 and, you know, and so on and so on and so forth. And I'm still doing the same thing right now. It's just the bigger numbers and the big different strategies and so forth. But that's the game that I'm trying to play. It's exactly the game I was playing 15 years ago or 20 years ago whenever I was, doing stuff with Steve and the positive cash flow days. So right now, I'm busily in trading mode as opposed to in hold mode. Now, I'm also 20 years older than what I used to be as well. So I've also got one eye on the future saying, well, at a point in time, you're not going to keep doing that. So you're going to actually, you're going to hold some stuff. And so I'm about to come to the round the board where not only will I develop stuff, but I'll actually keep some of the stuff that I develop, whatever that thing is, whether it be a group of shops or it's a group of houses or what have you, where you actually keep it and hold it for the rental stream. So, but I haven't done that yet. That's like, next week's game or next year's game or something like that. So the current round the board before I collect my $200 and, go in again is trading. The next one will be, all right, you've traded enough, now you need to retain some of this stuff.
Bradley shares a little bit about where he grew up before moving to Australia.
So I was 11. We came out from the northwest of England in search of a better life. Essentially, I was growing up and my parents were going through what I think was known as Thatcher's Britain. And the northwest of England was a lot of factories and mills and they were all shutting. And the youth unemployment rate was something like 40 or 50%. So my parents sought out to immigrate to Australia as a way of getting a better life.
In discovering who he was as a person, he set himself the goal to become a chartered accountant.
First, we moved to Sydney, and then a few years later, we moved to Melbourne. So I have very mixed memories of growing up. I don't necessarily have friends from you went to prep with and this sort of stuff because that wasn't my experience. What it did do is it put a couple of virtues that got instilled in me from a young age. The first one was that I spent a lot of time by myself because coming out from England and not having any family here and getting to make friends, I spent a lot of time just me. So I became very comfortable with who I was. So I became very comfortable with what I did, and I learned from very young age that I didn't really care what other people thought of me because it was just me. The other thing that got instilled into me from a young age is I remember my parents, not say fighting about money, but I heard them complaining about money. And so I never had money there. We never went without or anything like that. But my parents sacrificed a great deal and we never had money. And I remember saying to myself, probably about 13, 14, I'm not going to do that. I remember one particular day, my mum, came out of my bedroom or lounge room, wherever I was, and she said, I'm going to take $50 from the bank card to pay off the Visa card. That was their financial plan or their financial strategies at the time was just to stay alive. And I went, I'm not doing this. So I had a friend at school and his dad was an accountant. And I asked what an accountant did accountants were the people who greased the wheels of behind all big businesses was accountants. And I thought that accountants made lots and lots of money. So at that point in time, I said, well, I'm going to be an accountant then. That was as simple as that. I thought accountants equal lots of money, so that I'll do that. So I went through, I finished my schooling and I actually went to start my degree, my accounting degree. And I ended up, long story very short, ended up doing it at night school and working in a chartered accounting office. I was really, really fortunate that the chartered accounting office had lots and lots of clients, of which a lot of them were super wealthy. And the common goal amongst, or the common trait amongst all of them was that they all owned investment properties. And I came to the conclusion, I went, maybe there's something in this. the thing about being rich isn't necessarily being an accountant, but they all seem to have one thing, and that's property.
From there, he began learning more about property.
Then I was very lucky that I had a mentor as a client from about 17 years old who encouraged me to do things, albeit that fell on deaf ears for a long period of time. But eventually, after I stopped doing accounting, I used to catch up with him and you know, we'd talk about what had happened and why it happened and so forth. And one of the things he attributed as a factor of success was being a migrant. You come back and you have a thing about being a migrant is being having a migrant mentality. And so, you know, people come to Australia because it's a lucky country, so you have to succeed. And so I still have that even today, going, my parents sacrificed a great deal for me to be here. That, you know, Australia is built on a whole bunch of migrants, and there's a mentality that they have because they come here to get things done. And so I guess, you know, my growing up, maybe not different to maybe a lot of people or most people, but certainly it's still a lot of values and a lot of experiences that I draw upon, you know, to this very day.
Although there was no influence from his parents in terms of property, Bradley gained insight from his mentors and peers throughout his career.
Very lucky I had a client who was a big time was a property guy, and you know, he passed away about 8 or 9 years ago, and I would catch up with him, you know, I'll say regularly, not as regularly as I would like, especially now he's no longer with us. But just, you know, talk stuff. And as I used to say to him, there'd be a lot of people you'd have had the chat to, because, you know, he took me for lunch one day and we had the chat about, you know, basically, I liken the thing. He was my rich dad, if you go back to a rich dad, poor dad scenario. So at the time, though, I didn't realise it. It wasn't until later on that I realised it. And so, and I was really fortunate that I, you know, had a few, like I say, sliding door moments where I went, okay. I now look back on it and go, they were fairly instrumental in informing my outlooks on various things. And even now, when I deal with certain situations, I will still go, you know, this guy was known as Murray, what would Murray do? And that, you know, I still see Murray's son. You know, as we catch up every so often and have lunch and talk about what we're both up to and so forth, I still talk about, you know, what would Murray do? And that's what I would do. You know, every time I see his son, I say, your father was an amazing man, not only for what he did, but, you know, how he reached out. And, you know, I wouldn't be anywhere near where I am right now without your father having, you know, crossed paths in their lives.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve into Bradley's property journey on how he branched out into his own accounting business with Steve McKnight.
So Steve and I were the two managers, and you know, we were basically, I think, you know, by hindsight, we were being pitted against each other as to who was going to be the next partner. Except we both spoke to each other and we both went, we actually don't want to be partners in this place, we reckon we can do it better.
How he got started in property.
Well, I was buying properties to rent. It was that simple. And then along the way, one of these properties needed renovating, so we renovated it and we learned how to renovate.
One of his worst property investing moments, when the GFC hit.
This same major bank used to run an ad after the GFC that said, what did they say? During the GFC, we were the first bank to really support people. I went, really? Man, you guys are leading the charge, running for the hills, was my experience.
And that's next. I'm Tyrone Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. Hey, podcast listeners, are you enjoying listening to these stories and want more? Then head over to propertyinvestory.com and subscribe to receive your free property case studies that I only send exclusively via email. Just one of the many benefits of being part of this community. These real case studies are from experienced property investors where they share specific numbers of their portfolio, their strategies, and much more. Simply visit propertyinvestory.com to get your free case studies. Now back to the show. As ambitious accountants, Bradley and Steve McKnight were working in the same firm when competition arose between the pair.
So I was, you know, working in an accounting firm, and I moved to accounting firms, as you do. I ended up working at a firm, which is where I met Steve. So Steve and I were the two managers, and you know, we were basically, I think, you know, by hindsight, we were being pitted against each other as to who was going to be the next partner. Except we both spoke to each other and we both went, we actually don't want to be partners in this place, so I reckon we can do it better, which is, you know, fairly typical of people at that age. You reckon they can do things better than everybody else. So, you know, what do? You go and put your name on the door and you put your own accounting practice name on the door. So Bradley McKnight Accounting Practice was formed off of one of the business. A short time thereafter, you know, Steve came to me and he said, I don't want to do this. I went, well, what do you want to do, mate? And so, you know, the real estate business started off in very, very humble beginnings, and around the same time we'd been to a Robert Kiyosaki seminar, and we'd sort of listened to the virtues of positive cash flow, and you know, we started buying some houses in Ballarat, and so it went on. I'm sure people have heard the stories, and off it went. People at the time and later on have said, "Oh well, anyone could have done that," and you're absolutely spot on. Anyone could have done that, but not many people did do that. So there was something that's clearly which was stopping people, which is more than just the physicality. So it's interesting as you come back and talk about stuff, because people always look to put an obstacle in front of their way. Oh, it's because you're an accountant that you were successful. It's because you're in the right place, because you invested in, you know, back in 1999, you did that. It's because of this, and it's never anything, it's because of them. It's always something else that is the case. And I think that's one of probably the biggest things that stops people from doing it.
On beginning their own accounting business, they had no idea how it would take off.
So, you know, we started our own accounting practice. For a number of years, the business model was we'd earn accounting fees, and I would make it in accounting fees. Steve would go and invest it. And before you knew it, people wanted to hear our story, because we had quite a bit of success doing some things with various investments. And so I think around the same time, you know, propertybusy.com, the website was born. And essentially it was a business where people, you know, the more investing we did, the more people wanted to hear about what we did, the more people wanted to hear, the more money we had, which meant the more investments we had. And the thing just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And, you know, I remember some of the things we did, you know, even now we're pinching ourselves going, there's no way that should have happened. And, you know, writing books, which is where Steve wrote the book, you know, which was the number one best-selling business book, and whatever. It's, you know, it was tremendously successful and a tremendously rewarding period of time. And you go, we're just two accountants who, you know, had a bit of a crack, is my take. So, you know, on and on it went, and it got to the point of, you know, you achieve what is known as financial freedom or financial certainty, or, you know, passive income goals, or whatever it is that you get to. And Steve and I got to a point one day and said, you know, it's probably time. You know, we both need to go our own separate ways. And, you know, and I still see Steve now, and, you know, good friends and all the rest of the stuff. It was just that the business part of our relationship had come to a natural parting, if you like. And that's, you know, and we still, you know, we have a foundation together, and there's all the things that we're joined with, and I see them. It's, you know, it's a really positive thing that happened. So through the business part of that, you know, we started off as a very simple thing, just buying stuff to increase our passive income. That was how we started. Along the way, we learned things. So you learn about velocity of money, you learn about leverage, you learn about skill set, and you learn about different markets and how things change.
Entering into property development occurred organically for Brayley as he shifted away from simple renovations and towards building.
I was buying properties to rent. It was that simple. And then along the way, one of these properties needed renovating. So we renovated it, and we learned how to renovate. So our second property we ever did was a house that Steve and I renovated with Steve's dad. And I can't remember what the budgeted profit was, but the actual profit was nowhere near that. You know, so there's a lot of these renovation shows where they show, you know, some guy putting a lick of paint on and making $1 million. That wasn't my experience. And so, you know, you go from renovating, and you went, I don't like that. So our second renovation project was a group of flats where the best thing we did was get a project manager in to do their actual renovation. I, in this case, became the manager of the manager, which is what I do particularly well. And at a point in time, the house couldn't need renovating. It had a backyard. So we cut off the backyard. And so, you know, and I forget the time frames, because around this time I went off by myself, but he started cutting off backyards. And I started buying backyards. And I started building backyards. And I started buying properties that could be developed into two townhouses, three townhouses, and it grew and grew and grew. And that's what I'm doing right now, is developing. So I started off a developing business by buying rental properties, and it grew and grew from there. And the only change I would encourage people to have is this notion of just say yes. So I bought my first apartment developments off a conversation from a real estate agent who said, do you do apartment sites, Dave? And I went, yeah, why not? I knew nothing about apartment sites, but I did an apartment site, and I figured I would learn on the job, which is what I did. I made whatever much money I made out of the project, but I learned a whole bunch of stuff along the way. So a lot of this notion of just say yes, or, you know, you're never too old to learn, or, you know, the market changes, if you like. And so what are you doing to change with the market? So I learned a lot of stuff. When people, I speak to colleagues now, or people who ring me up, or what have you, it's what are you doing to stay in touch with the market? I mean, right now, today's date is, you know, it's whatever it is in 2017, that the market is a certain way. The market was different 3 months ago, and therefore, by deducing that the market will be different in 3 months' time. How are you going to change with the market? And whether that's the actual construction market, whether it's the finance market, whether it's the buyers in the market, whether it's overseas influences, there's something that's always changing, which is influencing things. Are you changing with it? And so if you're still doing what you were doing 5 years ago and you're expecting it to, you know, come back in vogue, you know, don't be surprised if it doesn't.
The worst investing moment for Bradley came when he was halfway through developing a property at a time when the market was volatile.
The worst moment was post-GFC that was in that. And I had two projects which were funded via one of the big four banks, and straight off the bat, the bank said to me, "We are not funding your project." I'd already signed a building contract. Well, they didn't say we're not funding you. We said we're changing how we are funding you. And so, in the space of, you know, one afternoon or one morning, whatever, the phone calls have gone, because I'd already signed a building, I said how the contracts work. I'd signed a building contract with a builder, and I'd signed a finance contract with a lender. So my banker, well, my builder, doesn't really care where the money's coming from, as long as the money's coming from. So what that meant for my cash flow is it was about $1.5 million shortfall in my cash flow. So in the next 60 days, I had to realise, you know, a seven-figure sum of money. Which, you know, you go, right, that's nice. And so this same major bank used to run an ad after the GFC that said, what did they say? During the GFC, we were the first bank to really support people. I went, really? Man, you guys are leading the charge, running for the hills, was my experience, but it's there. And so that was, you know, one story. The second probably one was when I essentially got a call from the banks that says, you have too much money out the door. We want you to deleverage. And they said, and I can't remember what the number was. I think I had about $20 million out the door with them. And they said, we want you to be $10 million in 90 days' time.
What? How can they do that?
Absolutely. So you're talking, so you asked me, I think your question was, what was your worst moment? The worst moment is because you come back. And so I was in partnership with the guy at the time, and he was absolutely livid, wanted to, you know, go down there and do all sorts of unspeakable things. And I went, no, there's lessons in this. Now, at the time, I also wanted to do unspeakable things, I'm not going to lie. But you go, hang on, that's not going to get me anywhere, so what do I need to do?
His next step was to deleverage, asking the bank to give him 7 days to pull it all together.
7 days, I had valuations done on my complete portfolio, and I had a strategy of how I was going to decrease my debt. I sent it to them. I sent them a document that would have been, I don't know, 60 pages long. So a real estate agent's valuation backed up by comparable sales and my plan of how I was going to do this. Now, for the purposes of explaining something, if you've got a property that's half finished, it's really hard to sell a half finished property. So you need to finish the property and then sell it. Like, so you can't just sell something. So there was a plan that was done that. If you've got a property that's got a tenant there for another 3 months, you know, and you know it's an owner-occupied type property, there's no point trying to sell it now. You need to wait 3 months and sell it as a vacant property. So that was all part of the things that I was doing. So what did I do? I sent this document out, and a week later I rang up the bank and I said, so I was just checking you got my documents. Yes, I have, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Excuse me? Hang on. A week ago, you were about to pull the rug from underneath me, and now you haven't even had the courtesy to actually read my proposal. So I paused. I went, what does all this mean? They say, this is why the market changes. So everyone gets given the same amount of facts. Everyone reads the same stories, case of how you interpret it. So this guy had clearly, from the bank, been given a directive to reduce lending, for whatever reason, being the case. Whether it was they were scared about their exposure or whatever happened. I think by me, as I said, this is the accounting background, attacking the problem and going, there you go, this is how I see you with a problem, I can see why you see it's a problem, and here's how I'm going to solve the problem. I think they went, as a bank, whether they thought this directly or just by default, went, well, this guy's a good custodian of money, therefore we're going to leave him alone. We're going to focus our attentions on the guys just the letters to who haven't actually responded yet. They're the ones we're going to put our efforts into.
From this incident, Bradley had learned a valuable lesson that not everything will go according to plan.
My problem to solve, and I'll solve the problem. And so, you know, there's a few character traits that you learn throughout where you go, no, we'll be okay. I just need to solve. There's a problem here. I just need to work out how to solve this problem. And so when people say, oh, yeah, you were lucky, Dave, I go, no, you don't know what this sort of person does, or when you've, you know, you're in this in certain predicaments where you go, I have to solve this. And so there are plenty of times that I could spend the next hour talking about, you know, the problems that I've had in business with where things haven't gone to plan and what you do. I think suffice to say is that whenever I do a development deal now, one of the things I say to myself and to various investors who I partner with, I say, there's only a couple of guarantees in this project. And the first guarantee is it won't go to plan. There will be a problem. The good news is that I'll work out what the problem is, and I'll work out the solution to the problem. But if you go into a development or anything in life for a matter thinking you're going to have the best case scenario, well, you can't be that surprised if something goes wrong. You've got to have some contingencies and some plan Bs and some what ifs if this happens. And that one of the things I see commonly is, you know, people believing the best case scenarios, believing what people say or believing what they want to believe rather than, hang on, what happens if it doesn't go to plan like this? What are you going to do next? And that's probably what I've learned.
As with most of our guest's stories, there was a shining moment where everything clicked for him. This was when he realized the power of cash flow.
I was going down this road of passive income and positive cash flow. And I remember I bought something like 3 blocks of flour. I actually remember it really well. It was November 2001, because I missed my daughter's birth because I bought these flats. It was a different story. So I remember it really clearly. You know, I've still got that story up my sleeve for a 21st as well. So I'd bought these 3 blocks of flats. They're actually in Tasmania. And, you know, for people who, numbers wise, I paid $640,000 for these 3 blocks of flats. And the rentals per year were about, they were just under $100,000. And I went, wow, this is a great result. And, you know, so on. The positive cash flow of all the expenses was about $30,000 a year. So Steve was happy because we were making $30,000 a year. You know, the people in Seminar Land were happy because it was a great story and it was a nice feel-good feel. And I sat there and I went, I remember having a Barney with Steve one day, and I said, this stuff's worth it. I said, we should sell this stuff. And he said, no, we shouldn't. We should keep it as positive cash flow and blah, blah, all this sort of stuff. As you imagine the stuff. And my aha moment was I took it to market and I sold it. And I sold it for just a little bit under $1.2 million. So I turned $640,000. I'll ignore the purchase cost and selling cost for the purpose of this example. $640,000 into $1.2 million in about an 18-month period. And so the positive cash flow was whatever that – the aha moment was, even though the cash flow is important, what makes you truly wealthy is this – is what I call a balance sheet build, turning 600 into 1.2, turning 1.2 into 2.2, or whatever the numbers are. And if you're starting smaller, it's turning your $10,000 into $20,000, your $20,000 into $50,000 and getting started. So you need cash flow. And so a lot of people preach cash flow, and cash flow is really, really important because that's what keeps you survival. My aha moment was what will make me accelerate this quicker is if my net worth, my balance sheet, my books, whatever, if I can grow that at an accelerated rate, that is what will win me the game, if you like. And so all I'm doing right now is trying to do exactly the same thing. So, you know, the last property that I purchased for, you know, whatever money I purchased it for, I'm looking at it going, how much capital am I investing and how much can I turn it into as quick as I possibly can? That's what the game is.
Another important thing which Bradley realized was about timing in the property market.
There is never a perfect time. So in a sense right now, you know, I'll go for a run with a few buddies and they'll say, oh, it's a great time to be in the property market. It's an all-time high. I mean, you must be really happy. I go, yeah, terrific. When I'm selling, it's not that good to buy that because, you know, it's there, or it's not that good to finance stuff because, you know, I might pay $1 million for something, but the bank goes to value it, they go, oh, so we reckon it's going to be worth 900. So I'm going to give you money based on 900. What do you pay $1 million for? And you go, you ready? It's a hot market. I have to pay $1 million. So then go, oh, well, you want the market to drop then? And I go, yeah. loans, think I'm going to go get in finance if the market drops, when the bank goes, oh, we don't give anyone any money, we'll call the money in, or, you know, there's your stuff you're trying to sell. You know, so there's no such thing as a perfect market. There's only a few number of combinations and a few variables in there, and then they are never all in your favor. There's always something that is problematic that you need to solve. And that's the reason why a lot of people sit on the sidelines and don't get in and justify it by waiting for it to be completely perfect. And that's the reason why it's easy to transact, or easier to transact, because yeah, people want to do it, but there's something that stops them from doing it. And I think that something is wanting to believe that everything is perfect before you can enter the market.
So, inspired by Bradley's journey and his amazing aha moments, we'll keep the conversation going in a future episode on Property Investory, where we'll talk about how to apply his strategy.
Now, right now, I'm doing a lot of construction of townhouses, and I'm also doing some land subdivision. They're the strategies that I'm using right now.
Unpack his advice on becoming a successful property developer.
When you start doing multiple, the biggest thing that you need to understand is cash and cash flow and how the cash flows.
And that's next time in a future episode of Property Investory. Also, if you haven't subscribed to receive your free property case studies that I only send out exclusively via email, you can text me your email address to 04998810040 to subscribe. These real case studies are from experienced property investors, where they share specific numbers of their portfolio, the strategies, and much more. Simply text me your email address to 04998810040 to get your free case studies. Thanks for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.